Side Hustle Show 143, building a multi-million dollar e-commerce brand on the side.
Welcome to the Side Hustle Show, where aspiring part-time entrepreneurs learn how to turn their side hustle dreams into reality. Because your 9-to-5 may make you a living, but your 5-to-9 makes you alive. And now, your host, Nick Loper.
What's up? What's up? Nick Loper here. Welcome to the Side Hustle Show. Because a hustler's work is never through. Thank you so much for tuning in today. In this episode, you're going to meet Jeremy Michael Cohen and Fred Parada, lifelong friends who went into business together after finding what they thought was an unmet need in the market, a carry-on-sized travel backpack. You're going to learn how Tortuga backpacks came into existence, how they initially developed the product and prototype, a unique way they got their startup funds, and ultimately how they've grown the brand into a seven-figure e-commerce business over the last few years. Now, while Fred eventually quit his job at Google to captain Tortuga full-time, it's still a side hustle for Jeremy, who's a full-time filmmaker. If you've got a product idea or are looking for one and want to get into e-commerce, this will be a fun one. Let's roll.
Full-time on Tortuga after many years of it being a side hustle. We are four people as of right now with a gang of freelancers and contractors that really help make it all happen. Yeah, we'll be a seven-figure business this year. So took some time, but we've slowly kind of built up a team and built up a nice business.
And I think Fred's being a little modest right now because we're in the midst of really in the last couple months having, you know, we will have hired three new full-time people, including a person in China to handle our manufacturing operations there. So it's kind of been, you know, the last 6 months have been a lot of big growth for us, and we're, you know, doing interviews right now actually for two of the positions.
Yeah, you're being real casual about it. Like, hey, we're doing seven figures and we have like four people on our team. Like, that's big.
Oh yeah, you acclimate to these things very quickly, right? It's like as soon as you're whatever four figures, then you're like, okay, well, how do I add another zero? Like I worked hard to get here, but like that's nothing now.
Well, so where did you guys start? I kind of read the cursory overview about, you know, the romantic backpacking trip through Europe and say, hey, these backpacks suck. So what's going on there?
Yeah, well, it is pretty much that romantic. So at the time, Fred was working at Google living in San Francisco. I was living in Los Angeles and I was a film school graduate student living off of student loans. And I won like a $10,000 scholarship. And instead of just putting it all towards my tuition, I said, Fred, why don't we go to Europe? Or maybe, you know, we'd been talking about this for a long time. Fred and I have known each other literally our entire lives. My dad and both of Fred's parents are from the same hometown, which is our hometown of Newcastle, Pennsylvania. And we're best friends in high school and middle school. And we've known each other forever. Like, you know, went awesome. To the same classes at the Y when we were like 2 years old. So anyways, we go to Europe in the summer of 2009, and tickets were really cheap. And we just kind of did it. And Eastern Europe was even cheaper than it was now.
Yeah, perfect. Like peak recession time. I love it.
It was peak recession. Our flights were disgustingly cheap. So we go, I do a whole bunch of research on Craigslist. I buy an old Jansport that I kind of like the idea behind her. It was really specifically designed for travel. Fred bought, was it Go Light? Was that the company, Freddie?
Yeah, which is mostly a hiking company focused on making really light gear.
Yeah, so we get to Europe. My backpack literally breaks the first night. Fred's backpack is – I even remember it just like it didn't look right for traveling, and it was kind of –
It was bright red.
Yeah, it was bright red. It was very cylindrical. It kind of loaded from the top. And we had just the best time ever, but the backpack sucked. And maybe it tells you a lot about us. We were just talking about like, oh, you know, I think we could make better backpacks. This is stupid. I would do this different. I literally think we were on a very long train ride back from Croatia to Germany. And I kind of joked that Tortuga would be an awesome name for our backpack company. We get back to the States. Fred buys the URL, tortugabackpacks.com. We had both read the 4-hour work week and other similar stuff before then. Okay. And I knew that I needed to make some money because I'm an independent filmmaker, and I knew that I would need some money outside of independent filmmaking, which is not like the most lucrative thing in the world. And Fred, I think by then you knew you didn't want to work at Google forever. So it was really you know, I don't know, it's really great. And I think it's almost been disgustingly easy to be in business with each other for this long. Like, we've never really had any blowups or anything like that. And we're both pretty rational people. And we just, you know, we started the company and I was at film school and I was doing stuff at work and Fred was, I was doing stuff after school and Fred would come home after work and we just kept on going from there.
Well, it's one thing to say, hey, our current situation sucks, our current backpacks suck, these products could be so much better. And it's another thing to go out and do something or know what even the next step to do would be. Like, so were you like making mock-ups in like CAD software, or, you know, what was your next step in like actually designing this thing?
Well, I guess I think the best part is that we were both so stupid at the time that we didn't know everything that it would entail. Do you think that's true, Fred?
Yeah, the being naive is good for starting a business because, like, absolutely, you don't think about, oh, well, this part's going to be hard. I don't know how to do this part, which is really important, et cetera. You just kind of, you know, we rushed into it kind of headlong. I mean, the first thing we did was buy a domain name because that was the only thing that we did know how to do that okay. was like on the to-do list. But we certainly don't know how to, or didn't know how to use CAD, still don't, or how to design anything very well. So yeah, we just kind of started plowing forward. And by the time you get to the really hard parts, at least for us, we were already so committed to it. It was like, well, we've hit this hurdle. We better figure out how to get over it, as opposed to, okay, here's a hard part. Let's quit and try something different. We're already kind of invested mentally and emotionally.
I think Fred and I both have a personality. Like, if you were to tell either one of us, like, you're going to be the CEO of Microsoft tomorrow, I think I don't, you know, I think it would be like, okay, you know, I'll figure this out. And we just kind of went about starting the company in that kind of way. And I guess I take on lots of projects outside of Tortuga where I've never really, you know, I've never produced this kind of commercial before. I've never produced this kind of movie before. And then you just go do it and figure it out. And you have a certain amount of confidence that you'll be able to learn as you're doing it. So we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into, frankly.
Yeah, I can relate to that, or I can at least admire that from afar. Like, my roommate was the same way. Like, he'd go on this job interview and they'd be like, do you know programming language XYZ? And just straight up, yes. And having no idea. And then he'd go home and like cram for 12 hours and come back and do his like, you know, test on it, you know, the following day. And you do just fine. Just like, but I would never be like, yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know, I never even heard of that.
And yeah, I think I've bluffed my way into every single job I've ever gotten. But I think that's the only way you kind of move up in the world, is you just have to at some point do something you're not qualified to do.
There you go.
Plus, like, with the programming example, I mean, the important thing is that you know how to think like a programmer, solve those kinds of problems, right? The language is just kind of the means which you can pick up. It's more that underlying thought process that really matters, which is probably true in business too.
Yes, he's at Google too, by the way.
Oh, nice.
So, Brett, at this point, are you looking out to like Alibaba for manufacturing? Are you trying to find like local manufacturing? What's the step to actually produce? Like, do you do a prototype first, or you say, hey, this is what we want done, just make us 10,000 of these?
Yeah, it's so for us, it's usually a little bit longer process because everything we do are original designs. So, you know, a lot of people do either white labeling existing products, or you take something and you say, hey, move this part over here and change that. Mm-hmm. We do everything from scratch. This is just another example of, we didn't really know any better on what we were getting into, but this is became kind of how we do things. So, you know, made it a little harder to start up and get started and figure out what we're doing. But
and you designed it all yourself.
So the ideas, the feature set, that kind of thing we had, but we did hire. So initially hired a contract industrial designer to kind of turn a list of ideas and features into, you know, something that made sense as a total product.
Okay. And how did you connect with them?
We found him originally, that was on Elance. So we worked together just on that first project. And then we've worked a little bit longer term with another industrial design firm that we found through a referral.
Okay.
Which was later down the line.
And where are we at now?
And now we've just literally as of last week, I guess, hired a full-time industrial designer. So now we'll be able to do all this stuff in-house, you know, kind of keep leveling up our design chops and also hopefully move a little faster in the future.
Trying to build out some different product lines?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So let's talk about getting actually going from idea to having a physical thing. What's that? I don't know, like this whole process of like inventing thing, it sounds so quaint. I picture like, you know, Edison, you know, 100 years ago, like actually like inventing stuff. And then, you know, people still do this every day, but it still seems like a very difficult thing to get off the ground. What's that process? What did it look like for you guys in terms of finding a manufacturer to build a prototype?
Well, I'll say that was by far and away the hardest part, the hardest like initial hurdle, and probably even with our V2, the hardest part as well. It's easy to have the idea. It's easy to write up a list of features. It's easy to tell a designer to put those features into something. And then easy enough if you're a visual person or have some experience, kind of communicating about visual things, to get like a decent enough sketch and blueprint. But finding a manufacturer is very difficult. The first time we ended up, I think we wanted to work in China originally. We ended up manufacturing in Orange County in the United States. And pretty frankly, we had a terrible experience. And I think after that, we were, you know, as we started to scale up and go to version 2, we knew we need to go to China. And Fred, why don't you talk a little bit more about the process actually, you know, engaging with someone in China?
The US run ended up being, in retrospect, now that I know the term, I like to say that that's like our MVP, our minimum viable product, because we didn't really make any money on it through trial and error of trying to manufacture it. The design got kind of dumbed down, so it was ugly and, you know, sold, but very slowly. And, you know, a pretty low percentage of people who saw it actually turned into customers because it was too ugly for them to carry on their backs. As we redesigned the bag to be a little more aesthetically pleasing, we knew that we need to go back to China as part of the, you know, MVP kind of idea. We didn't really make any money on those bags because of the cost of manufacturing them in the US. Our bags are pretty big. There's a lot of features. They're pretty complicated. So it's very labor intensive.
What was your initial investment in terms of the product design, in terms of the initial manufacturing run?
I think this is part one of the coolest things we have to brag about. So it was probably about maybe $20,000 initially to really get going. We found a $15,000 interest-free loan in Los Angeles. Wow. From the Jewish Free Loan Association. And anybody in Los Angeles who either needs to get out of, you know, credit card debt or wants to open a small business, it's open to anybody regardless of religion, the same organization as other branches across the country. And then Fred and I probably put in, you know, let's say about $2,500 each. But, you know, we really got started with that.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great resource.
Yeah.
Open to all religions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And weirdly enough, it's more important that you're in LA than that you're Jewish for them. I don't know why that's a big limiting factor, but they have outposts other places.
Their assumption is if you're in Los Angeles, you're probably just Jewish.
Yeah, that's probably true. The San Francisco one, you have to be Jewish for that one because we tried to get a second one through them. But, you know, kind of live and you learn. But going back to your original question, so we knew we needed to move manufacturing to China to be able to scale this business and have the margins, you know, on each individual unit to be able to build a business and eventually pay ourselves and hire people, all that kind of stuff. So we end up kind of fumbling around a little bit more. The design firm that we were working with at the time referred us to one factory. We went through the sampling process with them, which is, you know, you give them the design, they make, they try to make the bag from that. And, you know, the first one's always a little screwy because you're trying to go from, you know, specs on paper to a physical product. So you get that first one, you make notes and you go through a couple rounds of revisions until you have a product that they're ready to manufacture. So went through that process with them. And then as we got to the end, they wanted, their minimum order size was so big that we would never have been able to afford enough to pay for an order of them.
And
so they wanted us to do 3,000 units right off the bat.
And I will say that we stipulated up front, both our designer and the factory, that we, you know, we couldn't make that many, that we want a much lower minimum order quantity. But somehow it kind of just got glossed over and we kept on moving forward. But, you know, just a piece of advice, like if you are going to start working with somebody in China, just be so vociferous. Just make sure everybody knows, you know, what your minimum order quantity is. And for your first, you know, run of a product, it will probably be low and lots of factories will say, no, we don't want to work with you. But don't waste 6 months of your life doing a whole bunch of samples and prototypes if you then won't be able to work with that factory, because you'll waste time, money, goodwill, lots of stuff like that.
So did you guys have to jump ship and start?
Yeah, we did have to. So as we got to the, you know, they wanted that's the trade-off with China. So you know, your unit costs are typically going to be lower, but you're going to have to place in a bigger order because otherwise it's just not worth them doing it in terms of money coming in, time to set up the production line, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, those are the trade-offs, but even then 3,000 pieces was a little bit high for us. So eventually found another factory also through the same designer through a referral that would work with us, do a smaller run. That first run in the US was 100 pieces. So couldn't really go from 100 to 3,000, especially when we didn't make hardly any money on those 100. So eventually found a factory that would do a smaller run for us and finance that through, we kind of re-upped the loan that we had with the Jewish Free Loan Association. We had paid off some of it and kind of re-extended our, you know, line of credit, if you even want to call it there. And then also did a small loan with a lending club, which is kind of a peer-to-peer loan platform, plus, you know, kicked in a little bit more of our own money, and got that first Chinese order, through.
And I will say during this time, so I was about to say all the things Fred just said. So at that point, we had to kind of put more money into the business to make it happen. But we had kind of we really strongly believed that the idea would work, that people like the product, that we had kind of invented something useful. But during that whole time, the entire process Fred just discussed, Fred and I were both working, doing other stuff. Fred was freelancing as a marketer and SEO guru and content guy, and I was working in the film and commercial industry, being on set a whole lot. So, you know, we got to the point where we had kind of like tested a premise and gotten a company, you know, to a second version of a product where we were manufacturing in China completely as a side hustle.
And it actually worked well, weirdly enough, as a side hustle at that point, because especially in the manufacturing stages, I mean, you know, with a business, there's always a million things you can be doing. But with manufacturing, you know, we send notes on a sample and then we'd have to wait 2 weeks to get the next sample back. So, you know, there's always kind of a downtime there where, you know, obviously we should be marketing the business and plenty of other things you can be doing. But because of the slow lead times and nature of manufacturing, it sort of lended itself to being able to be done on the side or be doing other work at the same time without like really, really handicapping the business.
Yeah. Two things I want to say there is, number one, I think at that point of a business, it's really easy to do a lot of like what I call pretend work or like playing business. And we kind of didn't need to, because Fred and I both had to like pay our bills in other ways, we didn't have to do that. You know, like we got the work done we needed to at nights during the weekend.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Lending Club because, like, you know, if this is 2009, 2010, like nowadays, it seems like the perfect like product that would go viral on Kickstarter, right? And there probably has been other examples of similar like travel products that.
Oh my God!
Go crazy.
Yes,
it's like, oh man, we don't even need to pay interest. We can raise money for free if we just, you know, go crazy on these Kickstarter campaigns. What did you do to sell the first 100 units? I wanted to ask about, you know, market validation. Hey, we're putting $20,000 into this, and granted, some of that's in the form of a loan, but we're putting some skin in the game here before ordering, you know, more of the big bulk order from China. You know, how did you move those first 100 to say, okay, there is a demand for this thing?
Hey, just a heads up, Fred's line has developed a little bit of static from here on out. He's still understandable, but just want to apologize for that.
Well, as someone with a marketing background and having read 4-Hour Workweek, I'm a little embarrassed to admit that we probably didn't do that much market validation, you know, talking to people and surveying and stuff like that. But, you know, we didn't do some of the testing that Ferris recommends and stuff. And, you know, part of it was that we knew it would be a more expensive product. So it was a little bit more difficult to do. And this was also before, I guess, Kickstarter existed, but it wasn't a big thing. So that didn't even seem like an option, or it was never even really a thought at that point. But yeah, the first 100, we, you know, mostly it was word of mouth. We did some like sending out review units and having travel bloggers review and stuff. A lot of it, I was writing kind of a lot of content that was sort of more SEO focused at the time. So if someone was searching for just anything around carry-on bags, hiking bags, and why, you know, how a travel bag is different from a hiking bag, any of that kind of stuff where someone would be like searching for a question or trying to solve this problem that we felt like the product solved.
Okay.
I was writing a lot of content around that. So, you know, that ended up being a small trickle, but then I think some of that kind of combined to eventually some of those pages started ranking well, to then the site started ranking well for travel backpacks. So that kind of nudged us in the discussion enough to be able to sell some bags. But I mean, at that point, we're selling like a handful of bags a month, like 2 to 5 bags a month. So, you know, it didn't take that much to be able to sell 2 to 5 a month. You know, you only need a few customers kind of coming in the door.
But we had basically no expenses at that time as well. You know, whatever the tiny amount we were paying for warehousing and our domain, but not a whole lot else.
So you guys did have somebody fulfilling them. What did that look? Because it's kind of big and bulky, like if you're going to store 100 of these in your garage or something.
We were using Amazon's fulfillment service at the time, which was probably perfect place to kind of like learn with. And we were only selling in the United States. So they weren't all stored in my garage.
Okay. And just out of curiosity today, so the products are for sale on Amazon and your own site?
We just got back into selling on Amazon. We did it for a while when they were also our fulfillment service, mm-hmm. but there were some issues with them and why it didn't work kind of for the business at large. But so we switched, but now we're getting back to sending a few units to Amazon and kind of experimenting there and trying to learn the lay of the land and figure out how we can be successful there too.
What percentage of sales do you see coming through their ecosystem versus, you know, coming through on your own site?
Well, we're just kind of getting back on Amazon right now. I think this is like a big project for us. We were off it completely for okay. years. So like it's negligible right now, but I think it's a goal to get it much bigger.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a good thing because it's like, you know, that's uncharted territory in a way.
Yeah, I think we didn't know enough about it initially, or I think, you know, honestly, Fred is leading a pretty big push, and it's kind of its own front to the war, let's put it that way, that we weren't even fighting.
And if you reach this level without, you know, necessarily even tapping into that channel the last couple of years, that could be big, especially coming up on Q4.
Yeah, and I think likewise within, you know, let's say the beginning of next year, we're going to try to push into to Europe in a more serious way as well.
So what, like, I'm still like just and in admiration of you guys, like to just say, hey, I know we can make we can create our own product. We're going to compete with Osprey, with REI, with Deuter, and we're just going to do it.
Well, the truth is we felt like and this is partially based on kind of the approach that Tim Ferriss outlined in the 4-Hour Workweek, is we felt like we in some ways weren't really competing with any of them. You know, when we started making the bags, the only kind of comparably designed travel bags at all were made by those companies that you just cited. You know, REI has one, Osprey has one, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But that's like one out of hundreds of bags that they're making at any given time. Like that is, they make that bag so they can slap the word travel on it, but that is not a priority. The travel market is not a priority for them. So we felt like, you know, we weren't taking them on head on. We were just kind of, you know, doing a little end around, and even if they saw and noticed, they would think it just wouldn't be a threat to them, you know, between us being small and that being not what their market is. We felt like we weren't, you know, fighting them head on, and that would allow us to kind of establish ourselves as, you know, this is, we make travel bags. That's all we do. There are no suitcases. There are no backpacks for any other purpose. And if you travel, carry on and, you know, want to travel light and all this stuff and kind of fit into that market, then, you know, we're going to focus 100% of our efforts on you, as opposed to we're going to knock one product every couple of years that we will claim is for you, but, you know, we don't really care about it that much.
Yeah, we felt, you know, doing a lot of research before we started, there was no one else doing exactly what we did at the time. We kind of think that, you know, Meinol kind of almost exactly copied our business model as an example, but you couldn't search, you know, carry on travel backpack and find something that was just made for that use case, which really was kind of the idea for the business. Like we thought we had kind of were doing something new and we weren't competing with anybody else.
I'm glad you guys said that. That's the answer I was hoping that you would give, but I didn't want to like force feed it.
No, it's a good way to get started, right? Look at what a big company's doing and go after something that is not a focus for them. It's the same. There are small startups making, you know, some tech product or an app or whatever, and then Google copies them or something, or Facebook does. But, you know, if those big companies, if that's like not core to what they do and where they make money, then they might compete with you for a minute and hang around. But, you know, eventually they're probably just going to drop off because they're not going to invest the resources there. And, you know, you can be thinking about that problem 100% of the time. And it's, you know, this tiny little sliver of their mindset,
yeah, which is weird, right? Because it's like I get on a plane about a million times more often than I hit the backcountry. So it's a more frequent use case,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's not a, you know, we felt like we were niching down versus those companies, but it's not like to a small market. I mean, yeah. there's a lot of people out there that still, you know, see the wisdom in carrying a backpack over a suitcase when they travel.
Yeah, and I think Ferris has a little phrase he always says that, you know, the initial niche is not the ultimate market for something. So we've obviously stumbled into like a much larger market than just the initial hardcore, you know, 20-something travelers we were targeting initially.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a good lead in. Where do you see this going in terms of future growth and product expansion and stuff like that?
I think we're working really hard to keep growing. You know, I don't want to necessarily put a number on it. I think we want to keep going up and up. I gave this comparison to someone recently. I've been thinking about us kind of in terms of Under Armour recently. So Under Armour started, they made a t-shirt that was really excellent for playing, for wearing under your football pads, and also worked really well for playing lacrosse in. And then they made other shirts and, you know, pants that went underneath your football pads for cold weather and stuff like that, and kept on growing from that. But, you know, made products with that were really excellent for a use case in a particular arena, that being like hardcore sports. I think we're somewhat similar to that. Fred, I don't know, what's your answer from a slightly different perspective?
Yeah, that's I think that sums it up well. We you know, we started with the original ambition was just to have like a product and a business that, you know, we thought would be more of a passive income thing. You know, you read the 4-hour work week and you kind of buy in 100% to everything, but
totally.
Didn't quite work out exactly like that. But I think it was a great first step to get us started. And, you know, now we've got two kind of luggage equivalent backpacks, a day pack. We're doing some accessories and, you know, kind of deciding where to go next. So a lot of that stuff is still an experiment, like accessories. And then whatever works, we'll do more of. And as we grow, we get more input from outside people. But, you know, a lot of what we've done to date has just been, hey, I want a product that does this, or hey, I ran into this problem on the road, so let's make something.
Yeah, another really something I'm really passionate about, which goes back to the very beginning of the company of scratching our own itch, is I want to keep on thinking about like what would the products that Fred and I would, you know, what would we kill for? What do we desperately want that doesn't exist, or that we can make dramatically better that we can keep on designing? So I don't think we don't want to throw a whole bunch of crap out there. I think we want to keep on scratching our own itch and make stuff that's just really, you know, we're the ideal target market here, and make stuff that, you know, we pony up our own money for.
Yeah, I like the Under Armour example. I think like even the example of like Rick Steves, right? He started out on public TV, I think, and then he's, you know, got his book empire. He does his tour groups, and I think he's got his own line of luggage too. So he's kind of like, it's all under that one umbrella, or that one kind of, you know, brand, but he's expanded horizontally quite a bit. Just for people who are thinking of, you know, creating a product of their own, starting an e-commerce store of their own, anything you guys would do differently if you had to go back in time?
I'd say don't waste a lot of money right now. Like, it's even easier, but don't waste a lot of money on the design of your website or logo up front. We got a logo from 99 Designs or something, a similar site. I would recommend doing the same thing and just get started with a free Shopify, or, you know, cheap Shopify and WordPress theme, but just get the ball going and just blog right away. I don't know, Fred, what would you say?
Yeah, I think momentum was really what carried us through, you know, 2 years from idea to selling something. So, you know, even if the steps forward were very small or incremental, as long as they were forward, or, you know, even if there's some backward steps, you have a few more forward. As long as you're moving and doing something, that kind of keeps you going. And, you know, sometimes you got to fill that in with stuff that's maybe, you know, not hugely productive in the short term, like, you know, I mentioned buying the domain name or whatever. But if it just kind of pushes you further down into being more involved, more invested, feel like you have some momentum and things are happening, then you'll just keep pushing through even when you hit some hard times.
I like it. Keep the progress moving forward.
This has been huge for us. But think about having a co-founder, and Fred and I kind of have like a very, you know, familial or brotherly or something relationship. And if you're married, maybe even think about starting a company with your significant other. But I think it's so helpful psychologically to have somebody to kind of keep you, to both be able to pick up the slack, but also keep you accountable. Like, there are a lot of times where either one of us were so busy that maybe the business would have died without kind of that, you know, that like really unsaid psychological pressure of, I don't want to let Fred down.
Okay. I like that too. Jeremy, Fred, thank you guys so much for joining me. Everyone, it's tortugabackpacks.com for your travel carry-on backpacks that hold a lot of stuff, and we'll still make it so you don't have to check a bag. we'll wrap things up with your number one tip for Side Hustle Nation. Jeremy, you can go first.
Use Asana when you're working on projects with teams. I've come to love Asana. You know, you waste a lot less time. Everything's really organized. It's great and it's free, and you can use it for your newfound business, your side hustle, your primary business, your family, whatever.
I'm gonna talk to my mom on Asana.
I would say, especially if you know you're working on something as a side hustle, to create some divisions in your mind, even if they're sort of artificial. Let's say you work from home for your main job, and then when you do your side hustle, maybe you go to a cafe to work or something like that. But when I was doing a lot of different client work plus Tortuga, you know, it felt like torn in a million directions. So any kind of artificial boundaries or limits or differentiation I could make between those was really helpful to me. So, you know, I don't know, change where you're working, change what you're wearing, anything that kind of change your mindset and say, okay, now I'm in the mode of this business or this project, I think is helpful, and will let you kind of mentally set aside the other stuff and really focus.
Okay, that's a good one. I like that one. Guys, thanks so much. We'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
This edition of the Side Hustle Show is brought to you by Airbnb. And once you've got your plane ticket and your new Tortuga backpack, all you need is a place to stay, and that's where Airbnb comes in. And last month, we stayed at some pretty nice Airbnb apartments in Istanbul, Florence, and especially Venice. The place was pretty baller. And I'm actually on my way to another Airbnb stay in Phoenix this weekend. It's a great way to travel and feel more like a local, have a little bit more space to spread out, and of course, to save yourself a little bit of money over a traditional hotel too. If you haven't checked out Airbnb yet, you can get $20 off your first stay as a Side Hustle Show listener when you sign up through sidehustlenation.com/Airbnb. And that travel credit is actually good for 3 years. So claim it now and use it wherever your next trip takes you. That's sidehustlenation.com/Airbnb. Now, my biggest takeaways from this call with Fred and Jeremy. First one, you scratch your first itch. As Jeremy says, hey, these big companies may have gaps in their product lines that you can exploit, like Tortuga did, if you see a need in the market that you would pay for. Right? There's probably other people like you that would pay for it as well. Number two, hey, start as lean as you can. Like they say, hey, we started with just a website, and you may even be able to get an interest-free loan from Jewish Free Loan Association if there's a branch nearby you. Number three is have a partner. Like this thing would never have gotten started if Fred and Jeremy didn't have each other to keep each other motivated and accountable. And I think it's the same case for my wife and her photography business. Had she not had her partner to work together, you know, they may have never gotten the nerve up to start charging money for their services. So the next one I have, I think this is number four, is just to make progress one step at a time. It's just solving one problem after the other. And it can be daunting and it can be frustrating, but it's just, you know, that constant progress that keeps you moving forward. So it's like in the case of their backpack business, it's like, okay, step one, we've got to come up with a list of features. Step two, we've got to get a design drawing. Okay, how do we do that? Step three, now we've got to get a prototype made. Okay, how do we figure that out? And you just kind of, you go and you go and you go, and all of a sudden you have a real product for sale that real people can buy. And the last point, the last takeaway that I have is Fred's final note about creating these mental divisions between work life, home life, and hustle life. And I thought that was a really valuable point to kind of trick your brain into saying, okay, this is my time. This is work time. Let's go get it done. So thank you guys so much for listening. If you like this episode, be sure to stop by. Let me know. It's at sidehustlenation.com/tortuga or /143. So tortuga is Spanish for turtle if you studied a different language in high school. So you'll find all the notes and links mentioned in this episode over there. Sorry, no highlight reel this time. I've got a little bit behind on my scheduling there, but those will be back next week. So until next time, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, let's go out there and make something happen, and I'll catch you in the next edition of The Side Hustle Show. Hustle on.
Thanks for listening to The Side Hustle Show at www.sidehustlenation.com.